I'm going to talk some bollocks first. So we've had a lot of people message asking us to do a very similar podcast episode as we did with the R5 and the Aspero 5 for the Caledonia and the Caledonia 5. And I now have a Caledonia 5, which I went and decided to ride off-road yesterday and had a great laugh with, but it is now filthy and I haven't cleaned it. Well, that's funny. Cervelo rep Dave has just texted me.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. He's a good guy.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, we like him.
We like Dave.
He's anyway, Scottish.
He's very Scottish, and he tells me I'm very southern. anyway, I was actually talking to him about the Caledonia 5 last night. We've a lot of people were asking if Phil and myself could do another episode, basically talking through the Caledonia, because I think it is probably the bike which probably suits like 80 or 90% of people in the Cervelo range, probably more than anything, just for its versatility, I'd say. And they look cool. If it's good enough for Wout van Aert at Roubaix, it's good enough for that's my theory.
That's a good theory to have.
It's
a bike that makes a whole bunch of sense, and it's for a lot of people, for a lot of the way we're using bikes these days. And I think, you know, I think the challenge we have in the industry, generally speaking, is we've been kind of building the same bike for a really long time. And those bikes were really shaped by racing. And of course there was touring bikes and there was bikes that were, you know, detuned for a little bit more, you know, reasonable ride quality for people who weren't looking for that kind of performance. But generally speaking, like in the world of carbon road bikes, you know, for a long time, we've kind of just been building the same bike over and over again. And whether or not that's appropriate for everyone, you know, has never been more of an appropriate question to ask than now. And, you know, with the number of people who've joined the sport, you know, in the past decade, even, I mean, we saw this kind of, you know, Everest level rise in uptake during the Lance years. And then they petered out a little bit, but the momentum, you know, stayed. But now the amazing thing is more people have joined the sport and we've kind of diversified the way in which we use the bike. You know, we've extended that kind of horizon. It's not so stuck. Like everyone that's going to buy a road bike is going to flip the front of their hat up and get in a club ride. Yeah. You know, now some people actually can enjoy riding bikes. You know, and that's kind of where the Caledonia sort of comes into place. And it's interesting that you mentioned Roubaix because it kind of plays a bit of a role in the design of this bike, for sure. Yeah,
it was for me with this bike, when it was first released, the first thing that really excited me about it was the video for the bike. The video just talking about the bike. And if you haven't seen it, just search for it on YouTube or anything and you'll be able to find the promo video that was done. And it's so relatable for so many people about if you go out for a bike ride with your mates. And that's part of the charm of it. It really is part of the charm of it.
Yeah. And it also, you know, I think it what's important about this kind of era of bikes that we're building now is, you know, the goal is not, and I think that video does a really good job of kind of laying it out, is there's no reason to sacrifice performance for the attributes that we need in a road bike that we're using today, you know. And this was always, there was always this sense in the inside of road cycling, it seems, that, you know, one of the old adages, like if you want comfort, you don't get performance, but that's just no longer the case. Like, we know more about that. And I think what's interesting about this category of bike, which we call modern road now, really comes down to saying, like, you don't have to spend weight stiffness the performance values that are quantifiable and always really important to us as a brand to have a bike that makes sense for the way you use it. You know, so you said yesterday you were off road at some point, you had mud guards on your bike, like, but you're not riding a crappy bike, right?
I'm riding, you know, it's a top end, fully integrated. All the cables are integrated and hidden into the frame, you know, carbon rims, carbon handlebars, carbon seat post, a mix of Durace and Ortega DI2, like, it's a top end bike with mud guards on it. You know, And some people hate us to mud guards, but my God, they're so good. You can't deny it. It's such a good thing to have in the winter. But it looks great. I actually think it looks quite cool with the mud guards. Equally, you take them off, and because it's got that little nod to aero and having all the integrated cables, it looks like a good bike. Like, it looks like a racy bike, even though it isn't necessarily a racy bike.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a nice sort of segue into this presentation that we're going to kind of walk through, because, you know, there's some background on what we're talking about. We're talking about this kind of transition out of just making a race, you know, a core race style bike with a, you know, that handles quickly, you know, like a GP bike or something like that. It comes down to looking at the changing scope of how people are using bikes. And this started a bunch of years ago. And this is, it's an interesting conversation to have, you know, with someone in Europe. Can we say you're in Europe anymore? Are you guys still allowed to be in Europe?
I still class myself as European, so. Okay. Yeah.
Where you know, cycling had a much broader catchment to start with. There's a long history of it. And certainly, you know, Grand Fondos have played a significant role, certainly on the continent, for your mass start events. When we translate that into the sort of North American market as a sort of microcosm, you start to see these trends that when we use this as a benchmark, and not that we're certainly a global company, we're not just making bikes for North America, but it's significant because the trend has played out globally in the same way. And that's that there's a massive decline in the number of actual categorized races taking place. So, I don't know what categories that they are globally, but whether you always call them senior three, or whether it's elite three or master's man or elite, you know, people aren't as ready to line up on a Sunday afternoon and get their heads kicked in as they used to be. Right. It seems like there's this massive decline in the people who have come to cycling that want to race. This coincides directly with the rise, both in North America and on the continent, this massive rise in the number of fondos, and whether that's gravel or whether it's road. We've seen this basically when you look at the numbers, we see a massive increase in the number of people who are getting into road cycling. So that we're selling way more bikes than we ever have before. You know, and you hope that 100% uptake remain in the sport for sure. And this, you know, is exponential growth. But, you know, realistically, if we have 75% of those people stay in the sport, we're still talking about millions of people who have found their way into this sort of beautiful thing that we do. What's different is, you know, fewer people are looking for that competition as much as they're looking for the experience.
I agree.
And, you know, and I've probably quoted this before, and now it's a paraphrase because to my discredit, I can't remember all the details. But the guy that set up Grand Fondo in New York, a bit of a clever guy, and he pointed out years ago that Fondo had quickly replaced racing for cyclists in North America who want to be involved in the sport at a broader level than just an independent kind of endeavor. And it really looks like marathon. So whereas marathon is generally deemed a participation sport, you know, you have 10% of the people who are there are actually there to win it.
Yeah.
As you work backwards through the start grid, you know, the 2,500 people or however many people are doing these events, you have those different categories. You have the people that are there for personal best. They're people that use it as a vacation and they're there for the experience of riding, you know, whatever Grand Fondo that is. There's people who want to do it with their friend. There's people who've brought their friends in. There's accomplishment people. You know, I did that, you know, the same as I ran a marathon and now I'm done. I'll move on to the next thing. It's Fondo is like, yeah, now I've done that 150 kilometers or whatever, you know, so it opens up the opportunity to have a much broader catchment. There's something for everyone in that, in model that's really compelling. And at a time when we started to understand more about tire size and durability and how to put people on bikes so they're comfortable, you know, one of the great sort of limiting factors to road bikes for years was the like put the bars as low as they can and get used to the seat kind of, you know, like, and now we say, no, we can find a seat that works and let's put the bars where you'll be comfortable. And suddenly it becomes accessible. It's non-weight bearing. You know, everyone can do it for the most part from where they live. It can be half an hour. It can be 10 hours. Like it's this incredible vehicle of change, you know, for people's health. So when we look at this backdrop of how people are, like, expansion in the market, more people riding, transitioning into cycling, adding cycling to road cycling to their, you know, their quiver of things that they do, they're not all going to race, right? And so then you start looking at building the bike that's appropriate for that rider, you know, and look at how a core race bike has evolved into the thing it is. And maybe you take the opportunity to spend some of those, you know, the value of some of those decisions to make the bike more appropriate for the rider who's using it now. And that's a long way of kind of getting to this discussion around what we started referring to as modern road. We're talking about this bike coming off the back of the C series or our core race stuff that we've really been committed to for a really long time. You know, we started this conversation internally about, like, why is endurance road, which was really this category for a long time, was referred to as the endurance road model. Why is that synonymous with being lower performance? Like, why is it that you can't have a bike that has all the performance values of the top end race bike that you're producing for the guys that are pro tour riders or elite riders or racers on the weekend or whatever reason you're still making those bikes? But why does that have to be at the expense of, you know, I'll use the term comforts, you know, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. So as we started to think about this bike and what it was that we wanted to make, we started to kind of talk to different people that were in the industry about what they saw as being this, what is the modern road bike? And I love this quote that's on the screen now. It comes from a guy who's a shop owner in an area that's outside the major center. So he's located in an area about an hour and a half outside of Toronto. And it's kind of where the roads end. You know, there's lots and lots of, like, thousands of kilometers of rolling paved roads, but they're kind of joined together by a bunch of farm roads, you know. Everyone in Canada lives along the border, right? Like, it's the way it is. And then once you kind of head north out of there, it doesn't take long till the infrastructure is such that you're in farm country. And so he's got this area where for years people were riding every road that was available, whether on 25s or whatever. So you can do it, but it doesn't make it the right bike for the job.
Yeah.
And then the additional thing that he sees is the influx of people coming from, you know, major centers nearby because of the access to lifestyle that's in this region that he's in, and starting to, like, transition into gravel or transition into riding. They're used to riding only city streets, and now they're starting to creep slowly down these back roads, worried about puncturing tires. And so you start to realize that these aren't racers. These are people that are enjoying cycle tourism, you know, as their kind of recreation. But the problem is this kind of history, the legacy of this endurance road bike that was in the market for so long was that they all have massive increases in stack height, right? With no consideration often for changing the handling geometry of the bike. So you sat the rider up more to facilitate, you know, a more relaxed back angle or, you know, whatever those reasons were. But the bikes themselves, we felt didn't really offer the opportunities to those riders who were looking for that opportunity that they could. So there's some really high-end endurance road bikes out there, but a majority of those sales came in that kind of, in that sub $2,000 USD price point. Right? Mm-hmm. Said the way people are using bikes now doesn't have to do with whether or not they can reach the handlebars, right? Like, let's make high performance bikes that meet the needs of the way people are using bikes. So basically this quote that comes from this guy, Kieran, is perfect for what we were kind of moving towards as well. It's got to look like a race bike because people don't want one that doesn't look cool.
Yeah.
It's got to feel like a race bike when you push on the pedals. And that's that reference to, like, not detuning the performance of the bike. Now, keep in mind, performance in this case is relative to how you're, you know, to what you're doing with the bike, but you don't have to make it a piece of junk because you're trying to make it cheap. Mm. You don't have to make it a piece of junk because you're assuming that if that rider needs a more relaxed back angle, that they don't deserve high stiffness or so, whatever, like, terminal. I don't know what the rationale is, but, you know, so it has to look like a race bike. It's got to feel like a race bike when you push down on the pedals, but it's got to be way more stable than a race bike. Right. And those two terms, race bike and stability, have been, you know, if you use the term stability in a race bike for years, it was sort of seen as being a pejorative, right? Like, it was a negative somehow.
Mm. Which makes sense anyway.
Yeah, right. So now it doesn't have to be a negative. Stability is a good thing if stability is done for stability's sake.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to negatively affect the performance of the bike. Right. So, you know, So getting to this, it's got to facilitate a modern road bike is not based on someone who's new to sport or has to sit up. Maybe they need to have a low minus 17 stem on their modern road bike, but they want to run 35 millimeter tires. Right. And they're not pedaling through corners at 50 km/h on a criterium, but they're riding for 6 or 7 hours. You know, like you unpack this thing, there's some opportunity to make the bike more stable without spending the performance. And this is this idea of modern road is like answer the needs of the way people are using bikes now. Yeah, we're still going to make core race bikes because people still race bikes.
Mm.
But now think about that other group of people who need that same performance, but aren't necessarily pedaling through a corner at 50 km/h.
Exactly.
So that's kind of where this whole thing sort of comes from, is the difference between like a Caledonian, maybe what we've done before, some of the other bikes that have traditionally populated the endurance road category, is that, you know, there's no expense spared in terms of making the bike go forward. It's really about just making sure that while you're on it, it meets your needs.
Mm.
So, you know, when we look at this, and maybe it's COVID, maybe it's the rise of Instagram and TikTok and social media, but it appears as though also, so this is anecdotal, but it appears as though there's more people sort of coming into the sport and like embracing that idea of long live long rides, you know? So, you know, people kind of, the sort of emphasis on FTP and eating the right things is gone. Now it's like a lifestyle choice. Like I want to ride for 7 hours on Sunday and let's go over that. Two passes, it'll get us to that town with the great croissant, yep. You know, and we'll run over. Let's go get a coffee or hazen. And then that's the beauty of that Caledonia video, right? Was the like mess. Guy bonks, you know, they're
big
flats, like, yeah.
Charges, Garmin, tons of little things.
Yeah. Yeah. So that
matching kit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is real. And, you know, as it turns out for us, that we have a bit of a benchmark with that bike we used to make for the pros for Paris-Roubaix, which was the R3 Mud. So in some ways, this is sort of typical of the situation that we find ourselves in where we have a pro tour team, right? So we got to build something for them to use because we've always sort of mandated inside that every bike we make should be used at the highest level of the sport. Mm-hmm. When we're thinking about this bike and what could be a great opportunity in terms of performance metrics, we also think that's kind of like a Roubaix bike. So we go, why don't we build that pro tour level Roubaix bike, and that beautifully sort of slots into this category of bike.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we talked about a Sparrow, or maybe it was R5, we talked about this bike, but this is a kind of a not so well kept secret in Cervelo, which was that we built these bikes called R3 Muds for the team starting 2010 probably. All it was actually a stock R3, and for 8 frames we put a longer back end on it and a longer fork for mud clearance.
Mm-hmm.
And this bike, you know, I apologize if I've run through this story before, so I'll do it quickly. But fundamentally what happened was we used to build these, we'd build 8 a year, give them to the team. They'd race them at Roubaix and Flanders in those days because they could put a bigger tire on and ride the cobbles. When we updated the R series in 18 or 19, we gave the team the bikes and they came back from a reconnaissance on the pave and said they couldn't ride them because they were too stiff. They would just ricochet.
Hmm.
Off the edge. So we kind of realized at that point that you can, you know, there is a too stiff. And what is appropriate stiffness for use case has become kind of a driving factor in our design philosophy over the last few years. So whether that's a Sparrow, whether it's R5, whether it's S5 or whatever, you know, we're paying attention to how the bike's being used and then factoring the stiffness into that ride quality. So it was clear to us that this idea of having a bike that had the ability to kind of wander a little bit, you know, meant the wheels were on the ground a bit more, so it didn't just bounce around and ricochet. And that became a really good spot for producing a bike that makes sense for a modern road bike. Is it's clearly stiff enough for the pros to sprint on and descend on, right? But it allows that just little bit of twisting, I think, for lack of a better term, in the torsional stiffness of the frame to allow it to stay in contact with the cobbles on bad roads, right? So that's what gives us that stability. Too stiff and they just bounce around. So it becomes a bit of a benchmark for us when we're talking about tuning stiffness for different platforms, is we start at that R3 mud bike and kind of work outwards from there. You know, the Caledonia 5 is like just a hair stiffer than the R3 mud. And the reason we did that was to take those qualities, offset the stiffness by playing with the handling geometry a little bit so it's more stable. I'll talk about that. But also take into account much lower tire pressures that we're running generally now. So if you build out, you know, if you detune the stiffness of a bike and then run a tire at 40 PSI, you've got a very different ride quality than if you're running that tire at, you know, 80 PSI, 90 PSI.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. The mud was just such a cool bike, though. It was so cool. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It was sort of funny the way that played out, because we did it for years. And then I can't remember which magazine spotted them. And then suddenly we had to make them for sale.
Yeah. And they're super rare. They don't.
They're rare. Yeah. We did a handful just to do it. The name Caledonia comes from not our Scottish friend David, but from. You know, we did a brain bike event a few years ago in, I think it was in York, and we stayed in a castle. And then in the morning we finished up, we came into the parking lot. David was outside in his kilt piping us out the doors of his castle to her. He's an outstanding character.
Oh, what a good human.
He is a good human. So Caledonia comes from, it was a tribute to the dismantling of the Toronto office. So we were in Toronto for 25 years or whatever. And we were just off a road called Caledonia. And Caledonia was this sort of, it was kind of a liminal or sort of hinterland street in downtown Toronto. Didn't really go anywhere. It was pretty beat up, broken pavement, lots of frost heave. And so it made sense as we transitioned out of our Toronto office to name the bike after that street, as saying goodbye to Toronto and reference the kind of crappy pavement that this bike is really designed to manage well.
Mm. And as you say, I just saw it in the previous one, that nod to the fact that it is a named bike as opposed to a numbered bike, because it's a bike that's focused very much about the experience of riding it, like the Aspero is as well. You know, we know this bike is being raced at Roubaix and Flanders and various other classics, but it is, you know, that's Jumbo-Visma's kind of stance. They have the ability to use all the range of bikes available, but it is very much on that experience side, like the Aspero being a bike which is about, you know, going and exploring and having fun on it. Not by any way saying it's not a racing bike, but it's slightly different in its way it's worded, isn't it?
Yeah, we talked about this for a long time internally, and you know, certainly as any company needs to evolve in a changing market. I mean, if we had stuck to just making core race bikes as the world transitioned, you know, as the world expanded and transitioned out of race, you know, for the most part, you know, that's kind of not a sustainable model, right? And it's not. Once you wrap your head around the fact that the technology itself is not the hindrance, it's the application.
Yep.
And then that allows us the room, you know, to do responsible things and still provide sort of high performance bikes. But that being said, we sort of decided that when we were naming the Aspero, that was the big consideration, was we're moving out of this space where we were building these bikes that were core. We called them core race, and they were always alphanumeric. And there's a long backstory as how we ended up at alphanumeric, but the truth was we ended up at alphanumeric as a kind of slight twist on a naming convention that we had previously. Like the early bikes weren't alphanumeric; there was the Air and the Soloist and all these, and then they transitioned to alphanumeric. And so when we did the Aspero, we realized that was a space that didn't it didn't call for that kind of like core race sort of attitude that goes with it. So that's why we decided to sort of transition our, what we started calling our experience platforms, into names instead of alphanumeric. So the idea being, we'll leave core races alphanumeric, and then as this side of the market grows, it'll transition into they'll be named as opposed to core race style naming conventions. So that's absolutely a big part of what we were trying to do. And you're right, regardless of what we call it, it's still a bike that's used in Pro Tour. Mm-hmm. So there are two of them. And we launched these together. There's the Caledonia and the Caledonia 5. And 5 represents our highest end version of that at a production level. And I say at a production level because, you know, we've had those project bikes like RCAs and P5X to a certain degree as a project, you know, domestic low production stuff. Caledonia 5 is our lightest platform in the Caledonia range. Mm. You know, and before I move on from this, I mean, I think what's important to note about the Caledonia versus the Caledonia 5 is that rather than, you know, the risk with having multiple levels of the same platform, a 5, and is that you make the 5 level 1, and then you say, now make this cheaper, right? That's generally not what we do. What we've actually done, and so that you don't have two bikes that handle the same way and react the same way. Our goal with all of these is driven by ride quality. In those 5 pillars, those engineering pillars we've talked about, you know, ride quality is a driving factor. So these bikes share the same stiffness profile and they share the same handling geometry. Mm. And the reason for that is because, remember that ride quality discussion we had, where we were talking about how stiffness, handling, and materials are all kind of woven together.
Yep.
You kind of play with one. And so, you know, if you just, the risk with this is if you design a 5 level bike and then you hand it off to a factory to build a cheaper version, then there's a pretty good chance you don't get the same bike. You know, whether it's heavier is one thing, but whether it's the same stiffness is another, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so what we tried to do was offer 2 compelling versions of this bike that still shared the handling quality that we wanted. So the stiffness is the same and the ride quality and the handling geometry is the same. Mm-hmm. All right, so here we are. This was obviously with Sunweb when we were doing a recon. That was the year it was canceled. So we would have actually debuted this bike in Roubaix 2 seasons ago.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what happened. So I think this is critical in the messaging, this understanding, again, just trying to reframe this category of bikes from endurance road to modern road. And I think that the key aspect of it is that modern road really starts with performance, and it's not driven by being able to point at something and saying there's a feature, you know. So I think a lot of endurance road when it arrived was like, look, you don't have to bend over and reach the bars. And you were pointing at the stack height, yeah, or you were pointing at something that did something on the bike. Whereas modern road, the transition is all of that and more. We'll bring this conversation back to performance as opposed to pointing at a feature that may or may not be a benefit to the rider. So what we're talking about with Caledonia is appropriate stiffness, you know, room for big tires, handling that's appropriate again to the use case. And that speaks directly to that, you know, like if you're going to go touring on your motorbike, a GP bike's probably not what you want. And for the same thing, if you're going to go do long days and you're not sprinting for the finish or pedaling through corners at high speeds, why do you need those same, you know, bottom bracket heights and steering geometries? So tune the geometry to add stability, but not at the expense of performance. Mm-hmm. Right. As you alluded to, it was really important for us to have mudguards on this bike. But despite some really elegant solutions over the years, we wanted to go even one step farther and have it so that even the mounts are removable.
Yeah. And it looks, you wouldn't even know that you had mudguards on it, that you could fit mudguards on it if you took them away.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Exactly. And it's just one of those weird kind of trigger points, you know, like you could, if you had mudguard eyes on an R5, it would suddenly become not what it is, you know, it would just perceive it as being something lesser. So we wanted to make sure that we could completely take those off. And the truth is that, you know, there's a handful of places in the world that love mud guards and a lot of places that don't use them. Mm. So it just made sense to have a removable solution. Yeah, so that's kind of what we were doing in terms of modern road. So let's kind of break it down a little bit. So as I said, there's two versions. We'll move to renderings here. Silhouette is very similar, but there's some slight changes in features. So basically, the Caledonia and the Caledonia 5 are the same. As I mentioned that, and we did that for handling purposes. They share handling geometry and stiffness. The Caledonia 5 is, the Caledonia itself uses round interface on the steer tube, nice 27 round seat post, 27 2 round seat post. So standard interface, easy to customize. It's got top tube storage mounts, and then it's all externally routed cables. Right? Mm. So we look at that as that's the kind of bike that's really suited towards someone who wants the performance, but they really want high serviceability. They're not as worried about electronic drivetrains. They're not as worried about aerodynamics, those sort of factors. So this becomes a really traditional kind of build with all cables run externally. Mm-hmm. The Caledonia 5, we leverage that aerodynamic opportunity. We bury the cables internally. So we kind of move all of the hoses and electronic shifting inside. It's lighter frame. Mm-hmm. You're talking about 950 grams or so for a 56 painted with metal parts. So sub kilo is pretty good. It's the D-shaped post from the R5, so a little bit more compliance and a bit more aero as well. So it basically is a lighter, more aero option for that rider who wants that kind of premium look and premium solution for performance.
And it's worth mentioning that you can obviously set the Caledonia up with electronic gearing and vice versa. You could set the Caledonia 5 up with a cabled gearing if you want, but the 5, the cabling will not be all integrated like it is with the electronic cabling.
Yeah, that's correct. There was a push a few years ago to run all control cables internally. So brake hoses as well as control cables for the derailleurs. It's a lot of work. And the truth is that when the dust settled on that, the amount of extra maintenance work required to transition to replace mechanical cables, which, you know, depending on the environment you're in, is usually once a year minimum.
Yep.
Some places it's two or three times a year if you're riding a lot. In other places, people let them go a little longer. But, to have to dismantle the entire bike to change the mechanical cables that often was an impediment for a lot of people. So it just made sense to say, look, as the industry itself transitions increasingly more so to electronic drivetrains at the upper price points, mm-hmm. there's less and less of an emphasis on mechanical shifting at those 5-level price points, so those 5-level performance values. So, you know, you're seeing it a lot in the industry where a lot of us are transitioning out of enabling technical solutions for mechanical shifting, for lack of a better way of putting it, on the higher end bikes, and then making sure that they're still 100% compatible if you want to run a mechanical, which is totally viable. Mm-hmm. But in that case, on the 5, you're right, the cables would run externally, so they're serviceable.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So we'll walk through the features on this bike. These are the things that are on both the 5 level and the standard Caledonia. So breaking it down, just kind of walking around, you know, focused on what the handling quality is. As I said, I come back to this one sort of defining moment in this sort of how do you decide how to make a bike more stable. You know, we have a lot of stuff to play with. We've got head tube angle, we've got trail value, we've got chain stay length, we've got bottom bracket drop. All of those things work in unison to control ride quality and stability on a bike. So for a bike like the Caledonia, because we're really focused on that stability story without it feeling like, a real dog to ride, we went with a 72-degree head tube angle. And head tube angle is responsible for speed of input.
Did you hear that?
Reaction time. Yeah, I did. He woke up.
He woke it up.
You know, so how fast the bike reacts to input from the rider or from the road. So 73 traditional for a core race bike. We went as far back as 71 on the C series bike, and you really noticed a much slower, you really had to push those bars around to get it to move. Mm-hmm. Trail is a stability story. We built this bike with 60 mil of trail. That's calculated with a 30 mil tire. So if you put a 25 on this bike, it comes back inside. It comes back into 50, maybe 58 and a half, 59 millimeters of trail. But that's a big stability story, but that has to be matched with the rest of the bike. So we lowered the BB a lot on this bike. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is one of those things that, you know, the challenge, if you just add a bunch of trail to a bike and you leave the bottom bracket height high, for example, you know, you're constantly playing with the center of gravity of the rider when you're making all these changes. And the bottom bracket is the one that is fundamentally tied to center of gravity of rider. Mm-hmm. Right? The lower the rider is, the more stable it is. Obviously, you don't want to get to the point where you're hitting the cranks on the ground. But, you know, if you don't need to pedal for a corner, like we've made these decisions around bottom bracket heights on core race bikes based on the requirement to pedal for a corner.
Yep.
If you're not doing that, then we can take that opportunity to lower that rider a little bit and get that center of gravity lower to add to the stability. So it plays off with these dimensional changes elsewhere on the bike to just improve that standard of stability that's in it. And then we used a 415 chainstay on this bike. And that's, I think you mentioned that this bike feels quite lively.
Yeah. Well, just before we started recording, it feels good. It does feel quite nippy and lively, as you say. Like, I didn't think, I'll be honest, I wasn't sure it would. And I was really, really pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. So traditionally you'd see that, you'd expect to see like a 410 or inside a 410 on a core race bike. Whereas we just pulled that rear center out a little bit more. So it matches, it balances off that trail value. So it's not so long that it feels like you're riding a tandem by yourself, mm-hmm. right? Where you got to corner, wait for the back end to come around. But it's like, it's tucked up in there. But it gives you that life that you need when you're out of the saddle or when you want to accelerate the bike, that really adds to it. And also in a turn, you don't have a big long back end to kind of drag around the corner with you. Mm. But again, the challenge is if we push that wheel into that 410 inside of 410, because of the amount of trail on the bike, you'd end up with a bike that oversteered.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about that previously when we were talking about Cervelo unifying the trail in all sizes. Mm-hmm. Those smaller bikes where that head tube angle comes back to 71 degrees or 69 degrees, and you've still got a fork designed for a 73 degree offset bike, suddenly you've got so much trail on the bike that it flops.
Yeah.
You know? And what happens in the case it flops and then just turns around the pivot patch or the contact patch of the rear tire. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that you do an arc to turn on and not a pivot point. So that's why we've kind of pulled it out there, but not so long that it steals from the thunder, you know.
Nice.
It is. The bike is UCI compatible, which for those for whom it matters. For obviously, if we're using it at Roubaix, it needs to comply with the UCI legislation on what a bike can be in this category. Yep. And there's 42 millimeters of tire room on this bike.
Now, this isn't a really important graph because I've had several people message me about tire clearance. And this graph is so important because it literally shows the range of bikes and how is explained as well, saying there's the room for it, because every tire and rim is going to measure differently. You can't exactly guarantee it every single time, but this is the room that's in the frame. So depending on your tire choice and your wheel choice at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, this came out of, you know, we're not alone in realizing that we needed to change the way we talked about tire clearance. But this means that everyone's empowered. So, you know, legally for us to put a bike into us, for anyone who produces bicycles globally to put a bike into the market, you have to provide 4 millimeters of clearance between the tire and the frame at any point. Right. So we can't, our control over that is only what we deliver, you know, at the complete bike level. So we can control that. Once that bike goes to the store and you buy it and you put whatever size tires you want on it, or you decide to take the wheels off that we supplied and go to a wheel that's 2 millimeters or 3 millimeters wider and a larger tire, you know, that there's massive opportunities for tire size creep with the combinations that are available to us now. Mm. So telling you how much room you have, it means everyone can put whatever size tire they want in it, right? If it rubs, you know, that's, you know, and we indicate in the manuals on how to calculate that. Like, you've got 42 millimeters of room before you choose your tire. If you think it's going to be a challenge, you know, if you're upsizing from what came on the bike or whatever the reasons are, put it on the wheel, inflate it, measure it, you know, and then also do a rollout dimension on it so that, yeah, you know, you're hitting the chainstay yoke or hitting the chainstays or seat stays or under the fork or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it means you can make the choice you need. What are you riding on yours?
I've got 28s on it, but I'm riding the Parkour's Outer, which is a super wide rim. So that 28 probably blows up to about 30, just over 30 on that rim. Right. So, and I with the mud guards as well, I don't think you could probably fit slightly wider tire on it, but I wouldn't choose to be honest. Yeah, it rides great with that setup. It's purely, I went for 28s, the 28 Schwalbe Pros, no, 28 Schwalbe Ones, which is a more durable tire. And the outer rim is Parkour's gravel rim. And basically, I had a set of them lying around. That's why I put them on it, if I'm perfectly honest.
How wide are they? You know?
Yeah, and it's super wide, and it blows up, you know, 28 up as a really wide tire. So it's kind of perfect.
Right.
So I think they measure 30 or 31, maybe.
Yeah, and that's what we say is you've got room basically for 34 and change to 30, you know. And then if you put mudguards on, you've still got room for 31.
Yeah.
So yeah, probably, you know, you're at the limit of that. But again, it depends on the mudguard and it depends on, you know, so on and so forth. So that's the legal responsibility, is this 31 and 34. But you can push that if you want, for sure. Yeah. This is something that we do for all of these bikes, whether it's a Sparrow or Caledonia or the new R5, is we always run the cable access points to the top of the down tube. And the reason we go in there is it's a point of least strain. If you want to go in on the side of the head tube or something like that, you got to add material to reinforce the frame. So we realize that if we go in that spot on the face down tube behind the head tube, really low strain, which means that hole costs us less in terms of weight. But what we have all these just inserts that go in depending on what system you're running. DI2 plug goes there. Excuse me. Alternatively, you can run 1x, 2x hose plus mechanical, you know, all those different variations just go into the same set of plugs.
Mm-hmm. It's really neat as well. It looks super smart.
Yeah, it's clean. It's a clean little system. And we use the same plugs on multiple bikes. So they're always available. And then the mudguard thing, I think this is really slick. This was one of those things that guys worked really hard on figuring out a solution for this that was outside of what's been done previously. And so what we did was we basically employed a series of removable mounts. Sounds, for those of us who have spent lots of time with mudguards on our road bikes, flatted in the winter, and, you know, you put the tire back in and you got to bend the chain, you got to bend the mudguard stay this time to get it back in the middle. So, you know, like all the sort of micro adjusts that are constantly in place. These guys came up with a solution that avoids a lot of that. And basically what it is that if we start at the front end, the dropout on the caliper side is threaded to catch the through axle. So it's an insert. So what they did was design an insert that has a wing on it that has a 5mm mudguard mount. So you replace that fork end. Mm. And then the mudguard attaches to that. On the other side, it floats. And so you basically, what you have is a situation where on one side, that mudguard eye stays attached to the bike. Mm-hmm. Other side, which is the drive side or the lever side on the front, mm-hmm, mudguard eye floats. It stays attached to the mudguard stay, but it gets captured between the fork end and the head of the lever.
Yep.
Right. And the only reason this really works in a perfect world is that the tolerances on 12mm through axles are so tight that the variation isn't enough when you put the wheel back in to have to muck about with the chains, the mudguard to get it back in the middle.
Yeah, so cool.
We you pull your wheel out and the mudguard's attached on the caliper side and it's kind of just floating around in the wind on the drive side of the lever side. And then when you put it all back together, it's captured. And then the back end mounts much the same way. The fixed side is on the derailleur side. So it mounts between the frame and the rear derailleur fixing net and it's in place. And then the other side floats. So what it means is that when you don't have mudguards in the summer, you just take these off. So they're not there.
Yeah, it's super easy.
Yeah. And then obviously a brake bridge area we needed. So we made a little plastic one so it couldn't be mistaken for a rack mount. So light and it doesn't mark up the frame when you have it on. And then of course we did our best to bury the frame mount eyelets. And the rear one, there's not much opportunity there. It goes where it goes. But the front one, we did an interesting thing, and that's, you know, lessons learned from previous attempts at this, but there's a chin on the fork, but the chin is only on the sides. So it's a nice blend when you look at it from fork on down to, but between those inside that chin, you realize they're basically blades on either side of the fork, for lack of a better term, because we push that central surface farther forward and put the eye there. And the reason we did that was partially for aesthetics, so that when you turn the handlebar, you don't really see that eyelet if you're not using the mudguards. But also, you know, a lot of the mudguards now have like an extended plastic piece on the bottom.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, it appears as though mudguard design hasn't changed much, keeping up with the times, and they're still kind of designed to sit behind the brake in front of the fork.
Yeah.
Right. And so what happens is if you take that mudguard, which is universal, and you put that tongue on the back of the fork, you've rolled it like, you know, however long, like a few inches down.
Yeah.
Right. And then in cold climates, like I'm used to, when you drop off the curb and your mudguard's frozen, you snap that extension off.
Yeah.
Right. So the idea was to push that surface a little further forward to bring that mudguard to roll that forward a little bit further as well, to give you a fighting chance of keeping that thing. So just a little kind of detail on, you know, caring about mudguard attachment.
It's super simple, but it works at the end of the day. And I'm a big believer that mudguards are fantastic, especially in the winter if you're going for a group ride with people. Mm-hmm. And I've ridden with clubs where if you turned up without mudguards, you'd be told to go away. Quite bluntly.
That's right. Yeah.
So, I know some people are really anti them, and I'll be honest, I don't get it, but each to their own.
Yeah. Okay. So let's have a look at the sort of two bikes in detail. And then, so if we look at it from the side, basically bikes ship with either the ST32 or the ST30, which is the carbon or the aluminum Cervelo stem. Designed to interface with our C-shaped steer. And we can talk about that in a couple of slides a little bit more. The 8009 bar is the one we use. This is our proprietary bar. It's very similar profile to what's been on the S3 previously. Very similar top profile to what's on the Aspero.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a sort of subcompact 8123 bar. Nice flat transition off the tops. And then this one has really nice deep grooves. We don't run the cables through the bar. We run them underneath the bar for service reasons. So deep grooves that capture and the hoses and let them transition. Obviously road disc 12, 142. There's a rear wheel cutout on the frame, which is not necessarily for aero. It's more for mudguard fit and clearance. So it gives you that opportunity to have a mudguard and still have a bit more tire clearance. A 42 mil room and the D-shaped post from the R5. So this is the same post. So they're interchangeable. Offset, 15 mil offset, and 25 mil offset.
Nice. And the zero one is was the one that came, wasn't it, when you started with the new R5?
So it was always zero and 25.
The 15 was a new one then.
The 15, yeah, the 15 mil offset for the R5.
I knew it was one. I couldn't remember what one it was though.
All of our stems and seat posts come with accessory mounts. So they all ship with the bikes. So there's a slot in the faceplate for that. And that handles either a Wahoo or a Garmin, or you can have an optional lobe mount style for GoPro as well. So lights or bags or anything that, or GoPro that fit on those mounts. Yeah. The fender talked about removable FDM. So if you are choosing to ride one by, it doesn't look like a bike that was designed to be anything other than there's a blanking plug that goes in place. Is that off? And then on the five level, the DI2 junction goes in the face of the down tube through that same opening.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
We've got a really nice kind of integrated frame and steer and top cap system, just sort of tidy things up a little bit and allow for that really broad range of adjustability we wanted. And this is critical because you want to keep coming back to highlight the fact that this bike was not, it was not a design mandate in this bike to make it a high stack bike. Hmm. It's a design mandate to fit riders who need it to fit the way they need it to fit it. So the fit profile on this is traditional Cervelo. It's the same as a Caledonia, for example, but there's a much broader range than we've ever had before. Mm-hmm. C-shaped steer. This is the same one in the R5 and the Aspero 5 currently. This is how we do it. We've got this stem that has this eyelet that allows the, and a nice wide body that allows the hoses to pass through the stem body and then down that notch in the front face of the stem, and that clears the upper bearing, and then it's free inside the frame. And so you don't get steering input from the hoses or cables that are routing through there. And there's a lot more room for slack. So it's just a much simpler system to use that allows for enough slack in the system to take the stem off if you're packing the bike or working on it.
It's such a neat solution. It works really well, really well. Especially with the new compression bung, which comes with the R5 and is now coming in, I believe is coming with all bikes now.
Correct. Yeah. We've moved away from the bond in steer type, which it had a lot of benefits previously. You know, the idea with that system, although a little bit cumbersome, was to offer a lightweight solution to reinforce the steer. Mm. Because forks break beneath the split ring on the fork. And that's either because it's been run loose, and so the impact is just constantly squishing that split ring and cuts it, or because it bonds itself onto something from lack of service and it moves with the bearing and carves a line in it, and then you're in trouble. So the idea with that bond-in system we used was to have a super lightweight version of a reinforcement. Mm. But with internal cable routing now, it's kind of a giant pain to do that for fitting reasons. So we've finally developed a removable traditional style expander.
Nice.
Yeah. So we have an integrated solution for the top caps on this. And when we talk about top caps, we're talking about the bearing cover, right? That the volcano cap, but there's a bunch of different names. Basically, there's two versions. There's a 7mm top cap, which is the traditional size. Like if you look at your bike and you don't have a tall one, you've probably got a 7mm. That's kind of where it is. So the basic one is 7mm.
I've got a second one. Can you tell I'm dealing with a puppy right now? He's settled down now. He knows I'm talking about him. He's hungry. That's what he's whinging about. Right. Yeah, it's all right. I've got him under control. I've given him a whale. Yeah. I'm back.
So the second top cap is 22mm. So that's that 7 plus 15. So spacer and a half, which is a pretty traditional fit. You can put up to 45mm of spacers on top of that 22mm top cap, mm-hmm. as well. So that's the highest bar stack we've ever achieved certified. So basically, there's your fit options. And believe it or not, we certified it with the stem flipped as well.
Just oh, wow. So you can go even higher as well.
You could go even higher if you needed to, for sure.
So what's so nice about it is that the with the spacers and everything, it looks really neat. It looks super smart. It doesn't matter if you've got a stack height on it at all, because it's mm-hmm. still, because they're sort of aero spacers, it just works really nicely, doesn't it?
Yeah, aesthetically, it really kind of, it comes together really nicely. It's those line up You know, the bits integrate really nicely. So you're right, you don't have that sort of, it doesn't have the look necessarily of having a massive enough stack, which is partially because they're flared a little bit. You know, that sort of 28.6 stack of spacers always looks, you know, especially when it's not, they're not tied into the stem shape. You always kind of really see it. So this gives you,
definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Hose routing, as I said, what we do is we actually run through a channel on the bottom of the bars, not through the bar. And then it sneaks in. The hoses kind of sneak in between the back of the handlebar and the back of the handlebar stem. Right. So they kind of nip around the corner. Mm-hmm. And that groove in the bottom of the bar is designed to help that happen without pinching. And then they come into the stem, and the stems are quite large bodies. So they have a nice smooth arc down through that notch in the fork and through the lower bar, and then they pass through and it's clear. Traditional routing, so the battery's in the seat post. You know, the DI2 plug is in the down tube, as I said. And then for mechanical, it's external. So the hoses will still run internally, but the cables themselves run externally.
Mm-hmm.
Talked about that, the DI2 mount, or the DI2 junction goes there. So that's the five, and then a really quick tour through just to sort of show you what the differences are between that and the other Caledonian. That's a standard round interface on the stem. Mm-hmm. So lots of opportunity for customization, external cable routing, and round seat post.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Accessory mounts are still there. Stem of your choice with an accessory mount means it would work with ours or whichever brand you have with you. The mechanical inserts on the face of the down tube. And then one of the things that this has that the five doesn't have is mounts for the top tube bento box or nutrition box.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looks like. It's a standard interface. Whether you use ours or whether you use a dark speed or a profile or whatever, they'll all fit on there. And then this has the same sort of recessed face that we do on the Aspero. So there's a blanking plug that goes in. So what it means, if you're not using a bento box there, top tube storage box there, you don't have the two heads of the bolts sticking up. You know,
it's a nice little feature, isn't it? That it's kind of hidden away at the end of the day.
Yeah, you know, if you have to get off your bike, you don't hit it. You don't hit the bolt, you know. As I said, we're using these little inserts. Depending on what your setup is, they are all available. And then this is an important slide, I think, to sort of finish up on, is the difference between, you know, Core Race and the Caledonia, just as a kind of refresher to kind of capture what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And since we talked about the R5, this kind of fits nicely together. So when we look at the difference between the two bikes, you know, fundamentally trying to figure out which bike, you know, appeals to you as a rider, which bike do you need, which one makes more sense. I mean, outside of riding them, you know, we would always say ride them and choose the one you like. That's the nice thing about this. If you can sort of see what the differences are here when it's spelled out. So a 72 degree head tube angle just takes a little bit of that nervousness off, whereas 73 is designed to dart around, you know, like it's designed to move around a peloton quickly, to corner fast, you know, to really be a precise handling bike. Whereas 72 means what is muted, for lack of a better term. You're not darting around from moving the handlebars as much.
Mm-hmm.
57.5 mil of trail versus 60. So trail value, like a little bit less stable on the R5, right? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, faster turning and faster reaction speed from the head tube angle mean you've got a faster handling bike. There's that shorter chainstay I was talking about. So 415. You know, just manages that trail value a little bit better, gives you more stability. On a 410, it's tucked up underneath you, so the bike darts around. And then at the end of the day, this bottom bracket height discussion comes into play. So the Caledonia is a very balanced bike from a stability standpoint, but it doesn't feel sluggish at all.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's a really good way of wording it.
Yeah. And then, you know, from a ride quality perspective, you know, I'll point out, and you can weigh in on this, having spent some hours on it now, that stability is also joined by a kind of subtleness that I was quite surprised by the first time I rode it. Like it isn't the stiffness profile is that of a bike that's been used at the Pro Tour.
Yep.
But it is so gentle to ride. It's very muted ride quality. Yeah,
it was when I got on it, I straight away was like, oh, this feels very different from anything else I've ridden. But I couldn't picture what it was that I thought was different. And the more I rode it and the more I intentionally rode into potholes, I did start to kind of get a bit more of a feel of it and understand that a lot of that was to do with how it does feel stable. Like it doesn't feel like, you know, you go down like near where I am, there's some like this beautiful hairpin turns. You go down these hairpin turns and the bike flows really nicely around it. You know, in contrast, I mean, the R5 equally flows nicely around it, but it's a bit more lively in a good way as well. But the Caledonia, just for me, when I think about it as a bike, like if I'm going out for a really long, silly ride and if I have a lapse of concentration, I want something that I can kind of rely on that's going to, you know, cover that lapse of concentration. And for me, like I took it off roading because I was like, there's like gravel trails all around where I am. And I took it off on those gravel trails just to see what it was going to be like. And I was really impressed. Like that's where I could feel an element connected to the Aspero and the Aspero 5. For me, it sits so nicely between the two. It really does sit really lovely between the two bikes, the R5 and the Aspero 5. And, you know, I remember when it first came out, I was really excited by it, but I wasn't sure if it was the bike for me, because I like racy bikes. But having actually gone and ridden it, I completely understand why it's designed. And, you know, and also, as you and I both know, we're both fans of the old C-Series bikes, which was such a good bike. It's such an undervalued bike that I think was maybe ahead of its time. And bringing out the Caledonia and Caledonia 5 has brought out a bike which is bang on trend. If anything, maybe ahead of some of the trends as well.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of lessons learned from... You know, I think every bike we're building these days, perfectly honest, is there's lessons learned from the C-Series, which is the way, you know, we should operate. You know, you learn something from everything you do. What I really liked about the Caledonia when I first rode it was how lively it was.
Yeah.
Compared, you know, the C-Series was very much the thing it was. And yes, you could ride all day long and it was so light and comfortable. But this had a bit more like this pops in a way that C-Series bike didn't.
Yeah, it has a bit more like a bit more fire in the belly, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's exactly it.
The C-Series, and I think that's very calm. Not very,
very calm. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I think that's a really good sort of summary of what the difference between endurance road and modern road is. Modern road, you know, you've got the fun.
It's
you know, we haven't taken the fun away from it.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can hear the squeaker every now and then. Marshall's currently he's eating his whale, which is what I'm. That's why my hat. I'm like really low to the screen is because I'm holding the whale, and him stopping running around like a madman. So apologies if I look like I was distracted at any points. I'm just watching a hyper puppy who has been asleep
for a couple hours. COVID puppy.
Yeah. Yeah. Silly little bugger.
But. I was finished with this. You were talking about how good it looks when it's built, and I was this is a photo that was taken from the early prototype testing, and come back to it, it does actually look good.
Yeah,
it looks like it looks proper, you know, like a race bike.
And it's exactly that. Like you can see, there's an element from the S series kind of relates quite nicely into this frame. The, you know, the drop stays, it feels pretty aero. All the integrated cables looks pretty aero. It looks like a good bike. And
does look like a good bike.
And I always like your prototype ones as well. So I just think they look cool with the white. And the green port is quite smart as well, actually.
Yeah, that's right. When you're scraping together what's available to build a bike with, you know, that's painful for you know, white thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's a special bike, and I think we've certainly seen it's been very well received globally.
What size tires are you rocking on that one?
Those were 28s, I think, on that bike.
They look big.
Yeah,
They look really big. But those Dura-Ace wheels are quite narrow, so I can imagine the tires.
They're quite narrow, so yeah.
Yeah. They'll probably balloon them up quite a lot. Awesome.
Yeah. You know, whatever's lying around for your winter bike.
Yeah. Well, I know you've drilled it. I know you've got a customized R3 as well. Right. Thank you so much for running through the Caledonia and Caledonia 5. I think like it's a bike that is probably the right bike for 80 or 90% of people, and they don't necessarily realize that. I'd highly recommend trying one out if you can get hold of one. That's what I would say to people.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're in a nice place in the industry right now, and where we've finally managed to kind of shift that narrative a little bit away from, you know, the sort of assumption that everyone that wants a road bike wants to go racing. You know, like the bikes have gotten so much better. They've become more appropriate. Mm-hmm. And the culture around road cycling has expanded enough its view of itself, you know, to be far more inclusive than it was 2 decades ago. More and more people have access to riding bikes and are interested in it than ever before. And the industry is meeting those needs, I think.
Yeah. That's very well summed. Very well summed up.
It's good to see you again.
You too. I'm going to stop this recording. And thank you so much, Phil. As always, you're a legend.
Thank you, Chris. Cheers.